they need to build the missiles they want. Clark asked, if it's just a pro forma type vote, what's the concern? Wayne Duke Sharps is the concern. Mary Pat has heard rumors that employees from Sharps Global Intelligence Partners have been walking the halls in the United Nations, trying to get meetings between Sharps and the nine members of the Sanctions Committee. Influence peddling? No question about it. Foley can keep Sharps himself away from the UN people, at least during their official duties. But Sharps Partners has agents all over Manhattan. She's concerned Sharps will find a way to get to these men and women and either buy their votes or affect the outcome in some way. Ding said, so, this damn well indicates Sharps is working for the North Koreans, right? Just like in Vietnam, his organization clearly is working in the interests of the North Koreans, but there is no evidence he is working for them directly. It is crucial you find exactly what Sharps and his minions are up to. But there's something more important than that. If we can find out he is working for North Korea in any direct way whatsoever, we can have him shut down ASAP. It is treasonous to work for a foreign power. Sam Driscoll said, why doesn't Foley just contact the FBI? They could watch over them. Jerry said, the problem with Sharps' operation always has been that they have their fingers so far in the cookie jar at FBI and CIA. They're stocked with former employees and people who are still in contact with those in the government that there is no way the FBI can get close enough to Sharps' operation to catch him red-handed. They've only got a week and a half before the vote, so they'll be running around going after the committee members. They'll have to take risks to get this done, and this creates an opportunity for you. After that call, Clark refined his hunt for Sharps' operators, and within hours they were tracking Edward Riley through New York as he met with United Nations Sanctions Committee leadership. It didn't take them any time at all to realize what was going on. Sam's photos of the man leaving the massage parlor in the rain were brought up on the computer. No facial recognition software was required. There were only nine people, seven men and two women on the sanctions committee, and this photo was clearly Hans Tischer, a 41-year-old Austrian and career UN employee at One Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza in Manhattan's Turtle Bay. Clark said, Edward Riley is Sharps's second in command, and he seems to be spearheading things as a director of operations. The rules vote next week is their objective. They're trying to affect the delegates on board to get them to vote no on drafting another round of economic sanctions. Sam said, we can nip this in the bud. Just let it slip to the press what Sharps is up to. That gets out, and he'll have to stop. Clark said, I considered that. But the problem is, Sharps is the devil we know. There are other unscrupulous private intelligence firms in the U.S., plus there are similar companies in other countries who could operate here and stay below our radar. And above all, interested nations could do the same thing. I have no doubt that DPRK is running agents here in the city. They could be tasked with targeting the Sanctions Committee membership, and we'll have no insight to what's going on. No, we can't tip our hand. If Sharps finds out his op is under surveillance, we will lose all the potential leverage we have in finding out how big this goes. We won't blow Sharps unless we can prove he's working for the North Koreans. That would put him in prison for treason. Clark gave a sly smile. And that couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Ding said, so we keep following him. If he meets with North Koreans, we hit the jackpot. But if we know who he's compromised, like this Austrian guy he just busted in the massage parlor, we can push back on them quietly to try and pressure their vote. Sam had kicked off his shoes, and now he rubbed his calves. He'd been on nearly constant foot follow surveillance for several days. I guess we'd better get back out there. He's in his office now, but he usually leaves around 4. Clark stood, No, Sam. You and Domingo stay here. It's my turn at bat. Good news, though. Dom will be here in a couple hours to give us another pair of eyes in the hunt. Chapter 31. Lieutenant General Ree was not one to micromanage his operations. At present, he had more than 100 different schemes and plans in motion around the globe, and they were most all being run effectively, some more effectively than others, by his subordinates. Counterfeiting operations, drug smuggling operations, weapons transfers to Syria and Iraq and East Africa, and weapons purchases from Iran and Pakistan, kidnappings in Japan and in South Korea, and Firax, the assassination of the President of the United States in Mexico. He couldn't involve himself any more in Firax for the sake of deniability, but of all the other operations, the New World Medals operation was different, and therefore it required his full attention and scrutiny. As far as Ree was concerned, the Daewon Su himself had gone so far as to threaten him with violent death if he did not attain the ICBM. He had 2 years left to do so, and Ree saw no possible way this would happen without the success of New World Medals and the Chungju Mine. So he kept an eye on every last aspect of the mission. Even though Ree and his RGB did not hire Duke Sharps directly, the North Korean lieutenant general knew all about the American man and his part in the plan. He knew the importance of the procedural vote in the United Nations, and he had been watching Sharps' work via reports he received from Oscar Robles. Ree felt Sharps was doing an excellent job with his coercion operation, and under any other circumstances he would have simply allowed his American proxy force in New York City to continue on. But he knew how utterly important the success of Sharps and his operation was to Ree's own personal fortune. And 2 days earlier, something had happened in Prague which further affected the equation. A team of RGB men had been looking for a low-ranking consular affairs officer who had helped them with some documentation they had needed to get foreign expertise into Chungju. Ree had not been micromanaging this situation, but he was, of course, aware of the underground railroad of scientists coming in to work at Chungju from nations that would not have permitted their travel. Ree had not even been aware the Czech consular official had disappeared, but according to the report he read this morning, the man turned up back at his apartment in Prague, along with two Americans. The North Koreans moved in. A rushed decision to eliminate the consular official was made because he was in the process of revealing aspects of the North Korean operation, and according to the surviving agents, the Americans had been ready to repel force with force of their own. Four North Koreans, three from Ree's own RGB, had died in a gunfight. Lieutenant General Ree had been deeply distressed by this incident because he did not know who the Americans were, what they knew about his operation or his plans, or what they would do next. He immediately thought of Sharps in New York City and how incredibly crucial a good result in the United Nations would be to New World Medals' continued transfer of the money he needed. Ree would not sit back and hope for the best from Duke Sharps. He would send his own operators to monitor the situation and, if necessary, employ stronger measures. He'd sanction his men to kill on the streets of America if necessary, because the stakes were high enough to warrant it. That wasn't Sharps's game. This Ree had been informed by his U.S.-based RGB staff. The American ex-FBI agent skirted the laws in his home country, but he wouldn't run crews of armed direct-action forces, so Ree had to look into other avenues for this. The North Korean permanent mission to the United Nations is on the 13th floor of an office building on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 44th Street, a block away from the entrance to the United Nations building. The comings and goings of the personnel associated with the mission are carefully watched by FBI Counterintelligence Division special agents, as well as many other U.S. government entities. General Ree knew he could not easily call his New York office and simply order up agents to fan into the area to protect Duke Sharps and his employees as they worked on Ree's behalf. But Ree had other resources at his disposal in the city. There are more than 200,000 Koreans or Korean Americans living in New York, and Ree had influence over hundreds of North Korean agents or expatriates residing in the area, and some of these were covert employees of the Reconnaissance General Bureau. There were even direct action agents in the city, there for the purpose of targeting North Korean dissidents or South Korean troublemakers. After a meeting and a phone call in his Pyongyang office, Ree had secured the use of a unit of 12 highly trained North Korean sleepers in Manhattan and notified their control of his desire that they watch over Sharps and report back. Within 24 hours of his order, the North Koreans in Manhattan had begun shadowing Sharps' Global Intelligence Partners employees while they worked their operations within the city. They were tasked with making sure the Americans succeeded in their efforts to affect the procedural vote, and they had been given the green light to use any measures and resources necessary to see that the mission was a success. Chapter 32. President of the United States Jack Ryan was officially off duty, or as off duty as a president ever gets. All his official responsibilities were done for the day, and this was one of those too few evenings where the agenda didn't have him meeting anyone after hours, or going anywhere but back to the residence. After leaving the Oval around 6, he had dinner with Kathy, Kyle, and Katie in the family dining room, and there they made plans to watch a Discovery Channel show about snow leopards. Katie had announced to her family recently that she was destined to be a veterinarian, and although Kyle had mocked her because he walked the family dog around the rose garden more than she did, her parents were thrilled with her young ambition, and they ramped up their intake of nature documentaries. Katie loved learning about animals, and Kyle enjoyed it as well, although his sights were set firmly on a career as a professional stuntman, and he thought it unfair that his mom and dad didn't support him by allowing him to build the scaffold on the back lawn with the mattresses below it, because without this, how was he going to ever learn how to fall off buildings like the real stuntmen in the movies do? Jack and Kathy put their foot down with Kyle, did their best to steer him toward something else, anything else. But as for Katie, the 9-year-old who didn't like to operate the pooper scooper in the backyard was, in her parents' eyes at least, well on her way to becoming a world-renowned zoologist or an exotic animal vet. Jack started heading back to his room to change to watch TV, but a steward let him know Mary Pat Foley was on the phone wishing to speak with him. He took the call in his study. "Hey, Mary Pat, anything wrong?"
"No, Mr. President, everything is fine. Sorry to disturb you like this."
"Not at all. What's up?"
Mary Pat said, "Mr. President, I think there is an opportunity here to get a human source inside North Korea, into the Cheongju mine and refinery operations, to give us much better elucidation on the situation there. It won't be easy. The officer will obviously be in great danger."
"Wait. You said officer, not agent. You are talking about an employee of one of our intel agencies."
"Yes, Mr. President, CIA. He's a Chinese-American, first generation."
She offered the president no more information. Ryan loosened his tie and leaned back. "You want a go-no-go from me, is that it?"
"Yes, Mr. President."
"The operation. How long in duration?"
"Open-ended.
We don't think it will be more than a couple months once our man is in country." "You are satisfied the backstopping of the officer's legend is good? The infiltration plan is solid? You are convinced
He has the best resources you can give him and a clear understanding of the objectives.
Yes, to all.
What about failsafes if he gets in trouble?
Mary Pat paused.
I could tell you about the training he has and the exfiltration options available to him if he is compromised. But I will be honest with you. If he is compromised while on the ground in North Korea, he will likely be captured and then killed, or else killed outright.
Is there a plan to coordinate with U.S. military in case of emergency? We have special operations troops near the South Korean border, of course, and the USS Freedom is in the Yellow Sea. SEALs on board the Freedom were the ones who found the launch tubes on that cargo ship.
We are going to play our cards very close to the vest on this operation, for purposes of OPSEC. If our man is compromised from over here, it will be ruinous to him and to any future efforts we might have. But I will notify JSOC that a personnel recovery mission is a possibility.
Mary Pat knew JSOC would just ask for more information, and although she couldn't blame them for that, she wouldn't give any more information unless Yao was on the run in North Korea. The very thought of this made her blood run cold. Ryan was thinking, too. He pictured this unknown officer as a man standing at a precipice and facing a tightrope that led to the other side. There was no net below. And Jack Ryan was the one who had to tell him either to turn around and go home, or to start walking. But he also pictured the future. A future where the west coast of the United States was in range of North Korean ICBMs. His deliberation was brief.
"Send him," Ryan said.
He wasn't as sure as he made himself sound. It was his job to appear resolute, even to Mary Pat. If he vacillated, it would add unnecessary uncertainty into her oversight of the operation. She needed to know she had his full support and backing, and even though the prospect of having a man on the ground in North Korea would probably lead him to redevelop his stomach ulcers in the next few weeks, his belief in the importance of this mission was without question.
Mary Pat said, "Thank you, Mr. President. No, we have our best people working on this, and I'll meet with them daily."
"I know you will, Mary Pat. You and I both know what's at stake, for him and for the U.S. Get the intelligence product we need, and then get his ass out of there."
"Yes, Mr. President."
Jack hung up the phone and went into the bedroom to change. Kathy was already there. She'd thrown on a jogging suit she liked to wear when lounging in the media room. She looked up at her husband and instantly asked,
"What is it? What's wrong?"
Jack faked a smile.
"Nothing."
He sat down on the edge of the bed, suddenly very tired. Kathy sat next to him.
"Jack?"
It was Mary Pat. She wanted my approval for an operation that would put a young officer in harm's way. He paused.
"I gave that approval."
Kathy hugged him.
"It's Mary Pat, Jack. She knows what she's doing."
He shrugged.
"It feels like bullshit sometimes. I have to make decisions based on less information than the people who seek my approval. I know a 50th of what she knows, and I told her to go ahead. Maybe I should have spent a couple days looking at the operation."
Kathy said, "You know, Jack, there are a lot of people who were paid to read all that raw data and put it into an easily digestible form for you. You are upsetting the natural order when you try and micromanage."
Jack smiled, the lines around his eyes pronounced with his lack of sleep.
"I know, and I trust the people we have working for us. I just feel like I should have as much information as I can get to make decisions as important as this."
"You can't know everything."
"True. But I can't always know more." He sighed a long sigh and let his shoulders slump in a fashion that only Kathy had ever seen.
2 more years of this. Jesus. What was I thinking when I ran this last time? Kathy brushed her hand across the well-worn worry lines on his forehead, around his eyes.
You'll miss this when it's over.
But when it's over, we'll have a lot more time to relax. He smiled now, took her hand in his. Yeah. He felt better. Just a little. But it was enough to get him off his ass. He stood and went to change out of his presidential uniform and into his dad uniform. It was the best part of his day.
Chapter 33. Having Dom Caruso up in New York, thereby giving Clark four sets of eyes instead of just three, had made a huge difference in the campus operation to gain intelligence in the actions of Sharp's partners. The other change to their operation that was proving helpful was that now they were primarily tracking the movements of Edward Riley. There was no question that he was in charge of the operation to influence the committee vote, and after the honey trap in the sleazy massage parlor the previous day, Clark and his men wondered if he'd managed to line up at least one vote in North Korea's favor. Tonight Riley took a cab to Chinatown at 9, so Sam, Domingo, and Dom followed him down. While Riley sat in a nearly empty dim sum restaurant on Mott Street, Sam took the eye in a nondescript charcoal gray sedan. He had to circle the block four times to catch an open spot on the curb, but he found a place on Baird near the corner that gave him a great backward view into the restaurant, as well as a fair angle of view to both the north and south on Mott. Once he parked, he pulled his camera from its bag and put it down between his feet. Dom was on foot. He'd arrived by subway, then walked across Canal Street, and he remained two blocks up on Mott and out of direct view of the dim sum restaurant. He wore a black polo shirt and khakis, and he sat alone at a fast food restaurant on the corner of Mott and Canal, but he had earpiece comms with the team and was ready to move closer if Sam had to bug out for some reason, or if Riley left the restaurant with his contact on foot. Ding was dressed in warm-up pants and a light sweatshirt, and he jogged at a leisurely pace south and west of the dim sum restaurant. While he listened in his headset to Sam call out news from his static surveillance up the street, he circled over to Columbus Park and made his way through pedestrians, all the while ready to head back and take the eye if Sam ran into any problems. With only three men in the team, there wasn't a lot of room for error, but Clark was back at the safe house on the Upper West Side, both monitoring the team's movements on the computer and working directly with the analysts in Alexandria on developing a better target picture on the UN bureaucrats involved in the sanctions committee vote. Just after 9:30 p.m., a woman wearing a beige raincoat walked past Dom's position on the corner of Canal and Mott, and then she turned to head south. She was one of 100 pedestrians he'd tracked in the past 10 minutes, so she barely stood out and he hadn't gotten a close look at her face. But 2 minutes later, when Sam described a woman entering the dim sum restaurant alone, Dom recognized her as a person who'd passed his static point. And when Sam confirmed that the woman had sat down at Edward Riley's table, Dom said she came on foot from the west on Canal. She either parked up there somewhere, or else she came up out of the subway.
Roger, said Ding. Sam, we need her ID'd as soon as possible.
Working on it, replied Sam. His digital Nikon had a 500mm lens. With this equipment, and at this range, he knew he should be able to catch her through the window and get a good headshot. Unfortunately, however, the conditions on the street were less than ideal. All the neon signs around were reflecting off the glass, so Sam couldn't get a perfect sight line of her face. So far, he could just tell she had dark brown or auburn hair. It was pulled back in a bun, and she appeared to be in her 40s. He said, only two females on the committee. He opened a small notebook on the passenger side of the car and thumbed through the images. He found the first female profile.
This is definitely not Noreen Page from the USA.
He turned two pages and found the other.
But this could well be Marlene Allende from Chile. Can't be sure yet, though.
I'll have to wait for her to move to get a better line of sight. As soon as he said this, he saw movement at the table. He had been looking for any exchange of property between them. But this wasn't that. Instead, the woman was speaking with her hands, and Riley was lolling his head back, clearly in some frustration. Sam spoke for the benefit of the rest of the detail.
Our boy looks pissed. This should be fun.
10 minutes into his meeting with the UN official from Chile, Edward Riley finally began to accept her words at face value. This was no bluff. The bloody bitch had changed her mind. Riley had brought the $25,000 with him. They'd agreed on this amount in an early conversation, that one while making the harbor crossing on the Staten Island ferry several days earlier. She'd come up with an excuse to cancel the first meet for the exchange 2 days after that, but she'd agreed on tonight without hesitation. Now Riley realized he should have been more concerned that the lady was getting cold feet about taking money for her vote. He'd always known this could happen. So far he'd managed to bribe 2 of the 9 officials, and he'd coerced an agreement out of 2 more by threatening them with scandalous revelations. But he had thought he had Marlene Allende in the bag already. Allende had a problem with money. She was a middle-class woman back home, an international law professor who, through merit alone, worked her way into a respectable but not terribly high-paying job in New York City. And here she was surrounded by men and women who made more money and lived better for it. Over time, her resistance to running up her credit cards had weakened. It was easy to spend lavishly here in New York, and she'd put herself $20,000 in debt. As soon as Riley and the rest of Sharp's partners identified her as a target, they snooped around her bank accounts, and in minutes he had his attack vector sorted. He approached her, shocking her greatly, but she certainly seemed excited by the prospect of a financial lifeline. But now it looked like he'd overestimated her concern for her financial problems, or else he'd underestimated her dedication to her organization. And this led him to a new problem. He needed her no vote. But more than that, he needed her discretion. If she revealed the scheme to bribe UN officials, Riley himself would be the one facing the threat of a scandal. He sipped his Tsingtao beer, taking a minute to regroup. Then he spoke, sticking with his Kincaid legend, the NYPD detective. With a Brooklyn accent, he said, "Look, Marlene, you came here tonight on foot. You wanted to meet me in this out-of-the-way hole in the wall. You dressed like you're in a frickin' Sam Spade novel, for crying out loud. You don't look to me like a woman who doesn't want to go along with the plan. Just tell me what it is you want, and I'll do my best to make it happen." Allende shook her head. "Nothing. I want nothing. I came like this because I am ashamed to be meeting with you again. If someone I know sees me. I want the money, of course. But I am no criminal. I have a duty to my organization. I cannot do this. I will not." Riley gave her a challenging look. "How are you going to feel when the vote fails anyway, because many of your colleagues don't share your bright and shining sense of mission? You are going to be the only one who doesn't benefit. I know you have approached others. I can see it on their faces around the office. They all want to know if others in the committee know about their secret. I am sure they hope everyone knows, so everyone will go along quietly." Riley raised an eyebrow, but Marlene Allende lifted a hand quickly. On her face, she had an expression of worry. "I will go quietly. Don't doubt this. I will not say a word about anything that has happened. It is not my place to hurt my friends and co-workers. But I will not join in this corruption." She stood. "I am sorry, Mr. Kincaid. Good night." Without another word,
she turned and headed for the door. Allende was still in the restaurant when Driscoll noticed the new arrival to the neighborhood. A small black SUV with its lights off pulled up to the curb some 25 yards north of his position on the corner of Bayard and Mott. He could just see one person behind the wheel, but he wasn't sure with all the reflecting neon from the Chinese character signs running up and down both sides of the street. Marlene Allende. Sam had confirmed her identity when he got a perfect shot of her face during her meeting with Riley, stepped out of the dim sum place and began walking up Mott Street in the direction of the black SUV. Sam had not seen anything passed between Riley and the UN woman, and now, watching the way she had spun away and marched off, he read it as a show of resolution. He got the distinct impression she was turning her back on Riley, figuratively as well as literally. Sam said, "Listen up. The woman is not going to play ball with Riley, and she is on the move, heading northbound on foot. A suspicious vehicle just pulled up on the corner." Ding called back, "I'm en route from the south." Dom said, "I'm in position if she comes all the way to Canal Street." Sam just sat in his dark car. As much as he wanted to tail the woman leaving on foot immediately, he wouldn't reveal himself by firing up his engine right now. Instead, he sat and watched while she crossed the street. While she did so, the SUV started to move forward, directly facing her. But a passing Audi sedan honked its horn and swerved to avoid a collision with the SUV. Then it turned right onto Mott. The black SUV, all its lights still off, stopped and let the passing traffic by. Sam said, "Be advised, we might have aggressors. This SUV is thinking about either following her or running her over. Can't tell which yet." Dom said, "You've got to be kidding. In Manhattan?" Sam said, "I just call him like I see him. Wait one." The SUV pulled into traffic behind the Audi and went straight on Bayard, passing behind the Chilean UN official, who was now back on the sidewalk and heading north toward Dom on the corner of Canal and Mott. The vehicle turned on its lights as it took off up the street. Quickly, Sam looked back toward the dim sum restaurant. Edward Riley was leaving through the front door, heading off to the south in the opposite direction of the activity. He was talking on his phone, but he did not seem overly excited or concerned. Sam said, "The SUV has moved on, but they might be handing off the tail to another team, or else they're trying to get ahead of her. Can't explain it, but I have a feeling they aren't bugging out." Ding Chavez said, "Then we go on your intuition. I'll stay parallel of you to the west. You stay in traffic. Get up to Canal, and Dom will take the eye and the foot follow when the target passes." Everyone agreed, and the three men all began the orchestrated ballet that is a coordinated mobile surveillance operation. Ding was in condition yellow as he moved, his eyes open for any counter-surveillance. But he had no way of seeing the 70-year-old Korean woman sitting back from the window in the second-floor apartment over a bodega, the dirty curtains parted just enough for the lens of a video camera. She took 12 seconds of video as Ding passed below her. A minute later, she had sent the video to her local contact, an RGB officer. In a subsequent phone call, she told the man that the Hispanic-looking fellow in the video was unquestionably near the British man she had been ordered to watch over tonight. She was just a watcher. There were other RGB men here in the area, and they had used her for intelligence about the activities in the dim sum restaurant, but she had never seen her contact face to face, nor did she know a thing about the mission. She had been working on this job for the past several days. Once each day she would get a call from her contact, and she would go to the address listed, either a restaurant or a laundromat or a food court or a parking lot, or, in this evening's case, an empty and unlocked but obviously lived-in apartment on Mott Street in Chinatown. She would then keep an eye out for anything out of the ordinary around her. By her second day,
She recognized the one constant to each scene was the white man with the dark hair. She was not told his name, but when she pointed him out, she was directed to keep watch for anyone else interested in him. And now that she'd been at this for 5 days, she finally had success. The Hispanic man she had identified tonight had not done anything wrong. He had not gotten too close to his subject, nor had he acted in any way different from any other random passerby on the street, any of the 3 times she had seen him. That was what compromised him. The old lady had a memory like a trap. 3 mornings earlier, on 3rd Avenue, the short, dark-haired man in his 40s had been walking with another man, deep in conversation and with a cup of coffee in his hands. They were across the street and some 75 yards from where Edward Riley was having coffee with a contact at a Starbucks. The Korean lady had been stationed in a Hallmark shop, looking out the window and simply noting passers-by. 2 days later, in the mid-afternoon, a construction worker in denim pants and a T-shirt sat on a residential stoop in Chelsea, a block and a half from where Riley and one of his agents had gone into a brownstone. The Korean woman had been browsing in a luggage store on the corner. She'd been far from the construction worker, but she thought he might have been the suited Hispanic from 2 days earlier. If she'd had binoculars, she could have made the connection with certainty, but her cover was more important to her than his cover, so she let it go. But tonight, she saw the same man again, running in the dark, dressed like he was just out for a jog. He was either a businessman, construction worker, jogger, or he was a member of the opposition. She doubted seriously he was working alone, but she'd not managed to identify any Confederates. She neither knew nor cared about the reasons he was following Edward Riley, no more than she knew or cared about what Edward Riley was up to. But her grown son and daughter lived in North Korea, and her occasional work here in New York for RGB always brought good news from them. The last time she worked an operation here in the city for North Korean intelligence, her son sent a letter a few months later telling her he had received a new bicycle and his sister a new radio. They did not know the reason why, but they thanked the Daewon Su and professed their everlasting love and affection for him. The elderly Korean Manhattanite was pleased her work here in America brought her family happiness back home, even if she would have loved to be able to have them come here to live with her. The 3 campus operators continued their coordinated leapfrogging movements through Chinatown, and it was still something of a ballet. But by now the complexity of the choreography had increased because the black SUV had turned up again, this time shadowing the woman on Canal Street. Marlene Allende continued walking unaware, her beige raincoat contrasting with the T-shirts of many of the other pedestrians here, shopping for cheap knockoff goods in the rows of sidewalk stalls. Behind her, carefully tracking her, the Ford Escape moved normally through traffic, turning on to perpendicular streets and then pulling back onto Canal moments later. Caruso still had the eye. He was 100 feet directly behind the target, which meant at times he was moving right along with the black Ford. He spoke softly, but his earbud picked up his words with no problem. "This is starting to feel like that deal in Vietnam. I count 4 in the Ford. They aren't closing on her, but there are a lot of civilians around here." Sam had pushed ahead through traffic, and now he raced to the nearest subway stop on Canal. During Allende's meeting in the restaurant, he'd called Clark and asked for information on the woman. Clark read aloud everything the campus analysts had given him, and from this Sam knew she lived alone in an apartment in Midtown. She wasn't walking home, that was for sure. Unless the Chilean woman hailed a taxi, it was a fair bet she was going to go down into the subway. He knew there was no way in hell he'd find a place to park to go on foot, but at least he'd be able to identify any threats on the woman when she passed by. Dom had no concerns the UN woman was going to see him. She walked with her head down and her shoulders rolled forward. If she started to look back over her shoulder, Dom had the training to recognize the telltale body movements that would come before her eyes actually put her in position to compromise him. But the men in the Ford were a concern. They were alternately behind him, next to him, and facing him as they went up one street and down the other, and he assumed whoever these guys were, they had the training to be on the lookout for counter-surveillance. So Dom stopped now and then to look at cheap T-shirts and tacky wallets for sale in the stalls, and he just made occasional spot checks on Allende to confirm the other team on her tail hadn't yet closed distance on her. As he walked, he saw the Ford Escape leave the tail completely and move up the street. He called it out to his teammates, and they all surmised the Escape was heading to the subway station as well. Sam asked over the net, "What are we doing, guys?" Clark had been monitoring the progression of the tail. "You two have to call it. I'm not there, and Ding doesn't have the eye. Dom, I don't want you guys in the subway if I can avoid it. But if you think this woman is in peril, I'll approve you going down and watching over her. Dom, Sam, talk to me." Sam watched the Ford stop at the entrance to the subway. Two Asian men climbed out of the back and hurried down the stairs. Before Dom had a chance to respond to Clark's query, Sam said, "I've got two potential North Korean FAMs descending into the Canal Street station, both wearing light-colored button-downs under black business suits." FAMs meant the same thing to all four men on the net. Fighting-aged males. They could be spooks, military, or any other bad actor. Of course, they could also be insurance salesmen on their way home from work. But Clark was betting against the latter. "Sam, you stay in the vehicle. Ding, you catch up to Dom." "He's in view ahead of me," Ding said. It was evident he was still jogging, keeping his cover going as well as closing the distance between himself and the surveillance target. Clark finished with, "Ding and Dom, follow Allende tight. Go overt if you have to. Let the DPRK assholes know you're there, but keep her out of danger. No unnecessary risks. You will lose comms with Sam and I up here, so re-establish contact as soon as you're able. Good luck." In front of Dom, the Chilean woman in the raincoat descended into the station, unaware men were watching her at this moment, and equally unaware others were waiting for her below. Chapter 34. Canal Street Station was surprisingly quiet, even for 10:15 on a weeknight, but a light stream of foot traffic on the stairs headed toward the track. Marlene Allende walked along with the others, all but unaware of her surroundings, because her mind was still on her worries. She passed through the turnstile on her way to the northbound N train, her mind still unable to free itself of the stress of the past few days. She told herself she'd done the right thing. No amount of money would assuage the guilt she would feel for the rest of her life if she succumbed to corruption. She considered herself a good Catholic, and though here in New York she had made many mistakes, finding herself unable to resist running up her credit cards and blowing through her life savings, she at least had the backbone to know that accepting a bribe from shadowy men obviously working for the interests of an evil regime was no way to dig herself out of her troubles. She wasn't paying attention at first, so she didn't notice when, directly in front of her, two young Asian men walked on the platform against the flow of pedestrians heading toward the train. And she became only obliquely aware of them a moment later and took a step to the right because she sensed them in her path and approaching her direction. When she noticed the two men adjusting their gait to move again in her path, now just 15 feet away, she looked up. Both men eyed her without reservation, and they kept moving toward her. She slowed her walk in surprise. She didn't have the training to be instantly fearful, but she thought they were perhaps walking up to her to say something. At 8 feet, She sensed rather than saw both men reach inside their jackets. As her eyes began moving down to see what they were retrieving from inside their coats, her heart lurched in her chest.
Oh, God! They are police, and they know.
Just then she felt hands touch her from behind, grasping her at her elbows, and two men formed at her sides and began leading her gently but surely along the platform diagonally, out of the path of the men in front of her. As she looked up at them, certain she was under arrest, one of them, smiling, spoke in a friendly voice.
Marlene, he said. No lo creo. ¿Cómo te vas, amiga?
Marlene, I can't believe it. How are you doing, friend? She glanced up and saw the Asian men standing on the platform, their hands still in their coats, confusion on their faces. The men leading her to the subway didn't seem to notice them.
Todo bien, chica, the smaller of the two said.
He was on her left, and he continued to guide her toward the track's edge. He acted like he knew her, and was happy to see her, but it was clearly an act.
¿Quién es usted? She asked. Who are you?
The man on her right was a little taller, just as dark, but bearded, and he shielded her from the two Asian men who were now behind her. A few more people came forward on the platform as the train came to a stop. The Latino with his hand on her back, from his accent Marlene had identified him as Mexican, spoke softly now, still in Spanish.
Get on the train with us. It's okay, we're friends.
She did as she was told, not because she understood or trusted him, but only because there were two of them, and they moved her forward with gentle but unmistakable force. When the doors closed, Chavez turned around to look for the two North Koreans, but he couldn't see through the crowd of people leaving the train and heading for the exit. He thought it possible they had boarded another car, but he hoped the sudden appearance of him and Dom gave them enough pause to slow them down. Chavez helped the woman to a seat. She was compliant, but scared. He said, "Miss Allende, I don't want to alarm you. I am a friend."
Who are you?
She clutched her bag. Ding was a 47-year-old Hispanic male in warm-up pants and a gray sweatshirt. While he didn't look threatening, his approach like this was jarring enough to make Allende wonder if perhaps she was about to be robbed.
Those men have been following you since you met with Riley. We think it's possible they were going to hurt you in some way. We can't let that happen.
I don't know any Riley.
He may have given you another name. I'm talking about the man you met with at the restaurant on Mott Street 20 minutes ago.
Allende's face reddened.
I don't know.
It doesn't matter what is going on. We just want to make sure you are safe. Please, let us escort you back someplace where we can talk.
I don't know what this is all about. Really. I demand to be allowed to call my embassy immediately.
Chavez said, "You aren't safe in the subway. We can get you out at the next stop and meet friends at street level who can help us." Allende stood suddenly. Her confusion was subsiding quickly, and now she had acquired a sense of authority, even outrage.
"I told you. I demand to speak to my embassy."
The train slowed at the Prince Street station. Dominic moved for the door, his hand hovering at his waist, ready to draw his weapon if any North Korean operatives entered the car. Ding said,
"Okay, you can call whoever you want, but we've got to go up to the street, right?"
"I refuse to talk to—"
Dom spun away from the door, moved over to the Chilean UN official, and reached for his wallet. "Pay attention, lady." He opened his wallet and displayed his bureau credentials. "I'm FBI. You're coming with us."
"I have diplomatic immunity, and I don't give a shit. You were not being arrested. You were being escorted to safety. You need to appreciate what is happening. We're leaving right now."
She started to move, but it took her too long. At the stop, a thick crowd of some 15 people, the majority obviously tourists, were already boarding at the door nearest to Allende before she made it close enough to get off. an equal amount boarded at the door at the front of the car. By the time Chavez and Caruso had her moved through the group, the doors had closed again. The train began moving. Ding looked at Dom. Stand her by the door and keep your head on a swivel. At the next stop, we're moving. Roger that. If not for the large group of strap hangers standing in the middle of the car, Ding and Dom would have seen the two Asian men board from the door between their car and the car forward of them. But the men entered the car and began moving through the crowd, looking for their targets. When they did see the woman and her two mysterious protectors, they were only 10 feet away, close to the rear side door. Instantly, the North Korean operatives reached inside their coats to the small of their backs. Caruso and Chavez saw the men right as the guns came out. The North Koreans drew pistols, pushed a middle-aged woman and her grown daughter out of the way, and the guns rose in the middle of the group of stunned passengers. The two campus operatives went into their pants for their own weapons. Dom pulled a Smith & Wesson M&P Shield 40 caliber from inside his waistband under his shirt, and Chavez snatched a Glock 26 9mm from a Thunderwear holster. As Chavez drew, he stepped in front of Marlene Allende and shielded her with his body. The North Koreans got the jump on the Americans, but the Americans executed their draw strokes faster, so the race to get sights on targets was a four-way tie. The screams and yells of 30 people came last of all. Within 1.5 seconds of the two teams seeing each other in the same train car, the four men had one another at gunpoint, each with two hands on his pistol in a combat grip. Their extended arms and gun barrels meant their muzzles were within 18 inches of one another. Men and women all around them dropped to the floor or recoiled out of the way in all directions, but the four professionals stood still as stones in the middle of the train car. It was clear to Chavez these were North Koreans. He guessed they were members of their Foreign Intelligence Service. He was surprised they were operating in the city with firearms, but Chavez told himself a gun was a decent tool for an assassin, so it stood to reason these guys were packing. Caruso was on Chavez's right, and as it happened, he had his gun on the man directly in front of Chavez, while Chavez himself was targeting the man just 6 feet in front of Caruso. The North Koreans had crossed their aim as well. The four weapons formed a near-perfect X that rocked and rolled with the rhythm of the moving train, and Chavez couldn't help but think about the fact that he and the other three men would catch simultaneous point-blank rounds to the head if anybody on this train car so much as even sneezed. He pictured what that would look like to the captive audience here. One extra-loud bang, and four armed assholes dropping dead to the floor in a massive pool of blood. That would be one hell of a vacation memory for all the tourists on the train. No one said anything for the first few seconds, so Chavez took the role of master of ceremonies. English? Either of you boys speak English? Sweat covered the brow of the man at the end of Chavez's notch and post gun sight. Chavez didn't look at the man in front of him, because that was Dom's responsibility, and he knew Dom would have that guy covered. Chavez's man, dripping with sweat, had eyes that were wide and alert, but he did not seem panicked. He said, "I speak English." Chavez nodded. "That's good." He smiled a little, trying to bring even the slightest bit of calm to the scene. "This is a mess, huh?" The North Korean didn't reply. Chavez continued, "I bet you and your partner want to go home tonight just like me and my partner. Am I right?" The North Korean did speak now, but it was low and guttural and in Korean. He was talking to his partner, and while Chavez thought he might have just been translating for his partner's benefit, it didn't sound good at all. The guns wavered a little as the train began a bumpy curve to the left, but still four muzzles were pointed at four faces, and four trigger fingers took up the slack in four triggers. A female tourist in her 30s started to say something, but Caruso just hushed her without looking. Chavez said, Why don't you two lower your weapons and you walk out of here at the next stop? We'll let you do it. Matter of fact, we'd love for you to do it.
The leader of the two shook his head no. Sweat drained down his temples. The train began to slow for the 8th Street stop. In a voice that was demonstrative but cautious, because he didn't want to startle the dude with the gun in his face, Dom said, "Everybody relax. I'm a federal officer. Nobody move until we're stopped, but as soon as the doors open, I want everyone to leave the train in a quiet and orderly fashion." The North Korean said, "No, no, no one leaves." Chavez said, "If either of you take your guns off of us to point them at these civilians, we will shoot you dead." That sank in for a moment. Then Chavez added, "Tell your buddy if he doesn't understand." A college-age man sitting on the bench behind Dom said, "Sir, do you want me to..." Caruso said, "I want you to do exactly what I just said. Nothing else." The subway car was quiet, other than the rattling of the movement over the tracks. But when Caruso heard sounds behind him, a slight shuffling of clothing or a purse, he said, "Anybody who pulls out a camera phone will probably get themselves killed, but if you don't, I'm gonna throw your ass in prison. Stay still." The sound behind ceased instantly. It was a jolting stop at 8th Street. All four men stumbled a little, but the guns were back up and in their X in an instant. The men and women on the train, fortunately it was late enough at night that no children had been on board, behaved even better than Dom had expected. And in seconds, the train was clear. Marlene Allende was one of the first off. Caruso and Chavez noticed that the North Koreans, though obviously on a life-or-death mission, had the good sense to not try to stop her. They were focused on their difficult predicament. Caruso expected the train to stay at 8th Street. Surely someone would tell the motorman that there was an armed standoff on his train, and he'd sound the alarm and stay right there. But the doors closed, and it began moving again. He realized they were in the second-to-last car, and perhaps the people who'd scrambled off had been more concerned about getting the hell out of the line of fire and going to the exits, and less concerned about running all the way up the platform to the front of the train. Of course, everyone would be on their mobiles once they got to street level, or else they would tell the first transit cop they came across, so both Caruso and Chavez knew the train wouldn't make it past Union Square, the next stop. Chavez tried his hand at dialogue again. "The woman is gone. We can shoot it out over nothing, or we can just call it a night." The North Korean said, "We have diplomatic immunity." Caruso replied, "Who doesn't, really, at this point?" Chavez latched on to this. "Then drop your guns. You haven't done anything that will get you more than an expulsion. It doesn't have to end bad." The sweat on the Korean's face made him blink over and over. His partner said something in Korean, and the two men started some sort of argument that got heated. While they shouted at each other, getting more volatile by the second, Caruso spoke softly to Chavez. "They're losing it." Chavez said, talking over the consequences of failure. Dom took in a slow breath. "Dead-enders." Chavez knew what he meant. These guys were coming to the realization they had nothing to lose, and this meant, to both of the campus operators, they were in the same predicament. There was going to be a point-blank shootout in a minute, and Chavez and Caruso had nothing to lose at this point either. The North Koreans had stopped their arguing, and both Americans took that to mean they had reached a conclusion. The train began to slow at the Union Square station, and all four men softened their knees to absorb the inevitable shift in momentum that came along with pulling into the stop. Although they couldn't communicate it to each other, the campus men both felt certain the North Koreans were going to fire right as the train made its final jolt before the doors opened. That was their best opportunity for success, and their best opportunity for escape. Chavez said, "You trust me, Dom?" It took Caruso a moment, but soon enough, he thought he understood.
I trust you.
What are you saying?
Shouted the English-speaking North Korean. I'm saying I give up, answered Chavez. He took his left hand off his gun slowly and held it up in front of him, like he was telling the man with the gun on him he was going to surrender. Slowly he turned his pistol barrel away, changing his grip on the Glock so the gun rolled forward on his trigger finger. It hung upside down in his hand, the grip facing away from him. He turned away from the man he had been aiming at, and toward the man directly in front of him.
Here, take it.
As he said this, the man in front of Chavez, the one with the gun pointed at Caruso, took his eyes off his sights for an instant to look up at the man offering his gun to him. A change in the dynamic caused him a half second of surprise as he re-evaluated the situation. As soon as his eyes shifted, Dominic Caruso swiveled his body to the right and shot the other North Korean, the man with the gun on Chavez, in the forehead. The man with the gun pointed at Caruso, startled at the movement, and his eyes flicked back toward his gun sight. He recognized he'd been caught off guard, looking at one man and aiming at another, but he was still on target, and he jerked his finger against the taut trigger of his semi-automatic. But he never got a shot off. Chavez flicked his pistol around in his hand so the grip was in his palm and his pinky finger was inside the trigger guard. Though the weapon was upside down, the barrel pointed at the aggressor in front of him. He pulled his pinky back and fired the pistol upside down. The round hit the North Korean in the upper chest and knocked him backward. He stumbled back, and his gun fired once into the ceiling of the train. Dom Caruso swiveled his Smith & Wesson to the falling man and shot him twice more before he hit the floor. The train lurched to a stop. Out the windows on the platform, the two campus operators saw a sea of dark blue uniforms running down the staircase 25 yards away. The police weren't sure which car they were going for, so there was confusion at the bottom of the stairs. Chavez turned toward the back of the train, away from the police, and started running.
We're going for the tunnel!
They leapt down to the tracks in the gap between the last two cars. Careful to avoid going anywhere near the third rail, they took off to the south. Two cars behind them, the transit police held their weapons on all the cars. It would be 30 seconds before they boarded, and another minute and a half before they suspected someone had left the train to run through the tunnel. By then, Caruso and Chavez were halfway back to 8th Street. By the time they got to the 8th Street station, Caruso and Chavez had moved to the southbound side of the tracks. Since all the witnesses had climbed out of the subway car onto the northbound platform, the two campus men expected there would be a police presence at the scene there, and they were right. A dozen or more police, in light blue and dark blue uniforms, some carrying carbines or submachine guns, stood around with witnesses and other passers-by. But Chavez and Caruso climbed up on the southbound platform, 50 yards away from the gaggle of cops across the station, and they made it up to street level with no one noticing them. Sam picked them up a few minutes later, and they were back in the 79th Street safe house shortly after that. By the time Domingo and Dominic sat down with a bottle of water and a gun cleaning kit, campus IT staffers had already reviewed all the relevant NYPD and Metropolitan Transportation Authority camera footage in the area, and they saw nothing that identified their two operatives. There was always a chance some kid on the train had gotten his phone out, but this wasn't an event likely to have been recorded, for the simple fact that everyone on that train was in immediate mortal peril and knew reaching for a phone or raising a hand to point a camera might have earned them a bullet to the head. After spending hours on an after-action hot wash of the event with Clark in the living room of the safe house, they determined they had somehow managed to avoid compromise during the incident. No one had any idea just why the North Koreans were so hell-bent on killing a single member of the sanctions committee, but Sam's assertion that Allende and Riley had not managed to come to terms on whatever it was they were meeting about made them all think it likely Riley had notified the North Koreans that the woman knew about the operation to coerce committee members, and the North Koreans decided to silence her before she could talk. There was a lot of guessing necessary to come to this conclusion, but the facts all seemed to lead in this direction. Clark said, "Just like in Vietnam, the North Koreans are playing for absolute keeps on this. In situations where some other bad actor might just pull up stakes and bug out, or else threaten a non-compliant party, the North Koreans are using lethal means. This is an ugly game they're playing, and we cannot make assumptions about how they will act without taking that into consideration." Chapter 35. Adam Yao sat in a glass-walled conference room on the third floor of the office of the Director of National Intelligence. A window faced southwest, and he looked out over a green forested hillside that obstructed the view of anyone driving by on the Capitol Beltway. Adam was sure the hill had been built with security in mind, but it was nice to veg out for a minute and gaze at the greenery. But not for long. After a moment, he looked down to the reams of books, notes, and briefing papers laid out on the table in front of him. Time to get back to work. He had spent a full week of 16-hour days prepping for Operation Acrid Herald, the attempt to place a CIA asset into a rare earth mineral mining operation in northwestern North Korea. He would be leaving for the West Coast in the morning, heading to the Valley Floor rare earth mineral mine in California for more specific training and legend building, before heading to China, where the real work would begin. Acrid Herald was a code word operation. Only a select few in the U.S. intelligence agency had any inkling what was happening. For purposes of operational security, no one at CIA Station Seoul would be informed, and certainly no personnel from any South Korean intelligence agency would be read in on the plan, because of the likelihood North Korea had a penetration agent high up in the South Korean spy services. Even most at Langley HQ would be kept away. The op was instead run out of an office suite converted into a special operations center at the Audney's Liberty Crossing complex. A portion of Adam's week had been spent committing to memory all the code words, call signs, radio frequencies, and other information he would need in his weeks in the danger zone. His code name was Avalanche. This moniker had been computer-generated for him, and Adam liked the sound of it, especially because he'd been told a recent code name generated by the computer for a male agent had been Sunflower. Adam felt bad for Sunflower, whoever he was, and hoped his mission went off without a hitch. Having to call Control to request a quick reaction force extract for Agent Sunflower didn't sound like something Adam would much enjoy doing. He'd take Avalanche any damn day over that. This operation might have been an incredibly difficult and dangerous mission, but, Adam told himself, at least they'd outfitted him with a badass call sign before he left. While the plan was for Adam Yao to go to Valley Floor to learn the computer system he would be operating in Chungju, he knew he would already need to know his cover legend back to front when he got out to California, so he spent the afternoon of his last day here at LX2 digging deeper into his legend. This type of work was familiar to him, learning the life story of a fictional character, and he actually enjoyed the study. He felt like an actor preparing for a role, and although all the lines he would use on the stage would be improvisational, the better he knew his character's upbringing, circumstances, education, and life experiences, the better able he would be to bring his character to life. According to his legend, Adam was Shan Sin, a 35-year-old mechanical engineer and Chinese national from Nanchang who moved to the U.S. to go to the University of Chicago, but then overstayed his student visa by 14 years. The gangster miners in Shanghai would be told that he then took a job in the mining sector, where he became an expert in ore processing machinery, specifically the computers used to operate a hydraulic cone crusher, a massive grinding device that turned the ore into precisely sized smaller bits so that the rare earth minerals contained within could be removed through a series of treatments and processes, depending on the minerals themselves. The CIA had learned through its access to the Chinese gangster mining operation that the North Koreans already had the huge crushing machines, as well as the hydraulic system to operate them, all thanks to the Chinalco operation that had pulled out a year before, but the Chinese had taken their computers with them when Choi threw them out of his country. A new computer was on the way from France via Bulgaria, and the CIA had already intercepted it at the warehouse of a shipping agent and implanted the hardware that would allow Adam to use the device as something of a direct-line telephone back to his command and control here at Odney. The fact Adam, or Shan Sin, had lived and worked in the U.S. for the past 18 years would account for both his knowledge of the equipment and the fact no one in the illegal mining company had ever heard of him. As with all undercover work, of course, there was always the chance Adam would run into someone who had been to the places Adam claimed to have visited or knew the people Adam claimed to have known. So it was crucial he got his legend information down cold to pull this off. Like every good non-official cover officer, Adam was an expert at the ability to fold his own life experiences into his backstory. This always helped with a cover story, because the more truth involved, the less the chance to be caught in a deception. And he would hide the fact that he spoke Korean. He and his control officers on Akrid Herald were working under the assumption the North Koreans might speak more freely around the Chinese workers than they would if they knew one of their number could understand them. The relationship between the North Korean minders and the illegal Chinese workers was sure to be unforthcoming, and the CIA knew they wanted to hear as much as possible from the Koreans that was not filtered through channels going to the Chinese. Adam's Korean wasn't great, but he was trying to crash course his skill level up a notch with intensive language study on top of all the other work he was doing. This morning he'd worked on his language skills with a native Korean speaker, a translator and trainer at CIA. Additionally, he had listened to recordings in the evening for the past few nights, and this had retuned his brain to the language somewhat. But today they focused on vocabulary specific to the mining industry. Adam's study wouldn't end when he left Virginia for California. Instead, he would travel to Valley Floor with his instructor, Mayun, and she would play the role of his wife so they could spend the evenings studying together. He expected to be in Valley Floor no more than a week and a half. But another 10 days of language study might just make the difference between success and failure on the operation. And it didn't bother Adam Yao at all that Mayun was an attractive woman. Unfortunately for him, she was married, and her husband, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed CIA analyst from Boston, had popped in on them in the language lab a couple times. He seemed to Yao to be a nice enough guy, and although he didn't know the nature of Yao's operation or where Yao and his wife would be heading, overall he projected an air of support. It was going to be weird to live in an apartment for a week and a half with a married woman, but Adam knew this wasn't the weirdest thing he'd done working as a spy. Normal rules did not apply in this life. It was late afternoon now. He closed up one briefing book and reached for another. Just as he started to settle into some reading on ore processing, Mary Pat Foley knocked on the glass door to the conference room. Adam waved her in and stood. "Sorry to bother you, Adam." "Not at all," Adam said. "It's nice to see you again." She paused for a moment, then said, "Akrid Herald is a go. You leave in the morning." "Outstanding." She and Yao both sat down. "They're working you hard?" "I've got the legend memorized. I've got the codes and Comotec down cold. I've boned up on the processing of ore and the mechanics of the crushing systems in place there. But I'll learn the actual computer software in California. I'll keep working on my language." He nodded. "I'll do my part in Akrid Herald." Mary Pat said, "And I'll do mine, and see that others do theirs. I won't micromanage this up, but I'll be getting twice daily updates from your control officers. I recognize the risks. I know I won't be in the field with you, but..." "Madam Director, I know you've spent a good part of your career in the field. Trust me, the fact you know what it's like is very much appreciated at a time like this. Foley smiled. Adam gave her a moment to reply, but when he realized she was holding back, he added, "And although I appreciate you coming to see me off, I'm wondering if there is something specific you wanted to tell me." She looked out the window and over the trees. "I lost a good friend recently. An operative. Not too unlike yourself, although much older. He was one hell of a foot soldier during the Cold War, and even beyond." Adam cleared his throat uncomfortably. "You lost him?" "Murdered," she acknowledged. "He was out of the agency, but he did die in the field. We don't know for sure, but it's quite possible North Korean assets killed him." "I'm a little curious as to why I didn't hear anything about this in my workup for the op." "He wasn't on official agency work. He freelanced for a corporate intelligence firm. There is no known relationship between him and what is going on here. Not yet, anyway." Yao said nothing. "In my job, it doesn't pay to be sentimental. But I look at it like this. The moment I become something other than a human being, I need to get out of this line of work." "Understandable. I know about everything that happened in China last year." "Yes, ma'am," he said. She leaned forward a little. "And I know about Jack Jr." Yao had met the son of the President of the United States in Hong Kong. Ryan had claimed to be working for a private investment company at the time, but soon enough Yao figured out that was a cover story for an intelligence mission Ryan was working. POTUS's kid wasn't CIA, that much was clear, but it was also clear that Ryan Jr. was in direct comms with Director of National Intelligence Mary Pat Foley. Yao had thought it almost comically surreal at the time when he